Welcome, everybody, to the Laurie Institute again. Good to see so many familiar faces in the audience, and I think some new ones as well. My name is Alex Oliver. I'm the Director of Research at the Institute, and we are extremely fortunate today to have a panel of experts to debate this very provocative question of whether human rights atrocities have become the norm. This event and this topic were inspired by a very thoughtful piece late last year by Philippe to my left, who is a senior Human Rights Watch official, and I'll introduce him and the panel properly in a minute. The second proposition in Philippe's argument that atrocities have become the new normal was that it's time to re-energise the Never Again movement. That was, of course, the expression used by the Jewish Defence League founder Mia Kahana as a rallying cry to the world after the Holocaust. Yet, of course, genocides did happen again. Up to 1 million Rwandan Tutsis were killed in the first few years of the 1990s. During the war in Bosnia, the 1995 Srebrenica massacre killed tens of thousands and was held to be a genocide by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in 2001. More than 20 years later, Radovan Karadzic, the former Serbian political leader, was finally found guilty of various crimes, including genocide, and sentenced to 40 years in prison. In the early 2000s, civil conflict in Darfur between the Arab government and non-Arab groups claimed several hundred thousand lives and mass displacement of citizens. 12 years later, there are still more than 10,000 soldiers, police and civilians deployed on a joint African Union-UN peacekeeping mission there. Those atrocities spurred global action based on the principle, as Philippe set out in his article, that no government and no head of state should hide their massacres behind a cloak of sovereignty. Those atrocities and others in the last half of the 20th century spurred the creation of a new international law concept, that of Responsibility to Protect, or R2P, that was spearheaded by Australia's former Foreign Minister Gareth Evans around the turn of this century. But we have more recent conflicts in the Middle East, Syria and Yemen in particular, and in Asia with the plight of the Rohingya, and the world seems to have become somewhat paralysed, struggling to reach multilateral agreement even on measures such as sanctions and no-fly zones, falling well short of sending peacekeeping forces. Today, the United Nations estimates more than 68 million people are displaced worldwide. Perpetrators of chemical attacks, starvation, sieges and genocide have been acting with apparent impunity. Up to 500,000 people are estimated to have died in Syria. Around 50,000 have died of starvation in Yemen. Médecins Sans Frontières estimates that around 10,000 Rohingya died in Myanmar in 1 month in late 2017. So, a brief and macabre introduction to the question we're going to explore today with this panel of experts who are leaders in their field globally. Are atrocities inevitable, and have the citizens of the world become inured to atrocity? To briefly introduce, starting from my left, Philippe Balopion is the Deputy Director for Global Advocacy at Human Rights Watch. He's been with Human Rights Watch for the past 9 years. He's travelled to conflict zones including Burundi, South Sudan and Mali. He's been a correspondent with Le Monde, France 24 and Radio France International. Sophie McNeil is a reporter with the ABC's Four Corners and a former Middle East correspondent. She's worked across the Middle East, including in Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Gaza. She's received 3 Walkley Awards for reporting on Yemen, on the starvation of Syrian children, and for her 2010 investigation into the killing of Afghani children by Australian Special Forces. Chris Sidoti, finally, is an expert on human rights law, and since July 2017, he's been a member of the United Nations Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Myanmar. He's also been the Australian Human Rights Commissioner from 1999 to 2000 and has sat on the Australian Law Reform Commission as well. I think they need a welcome. Thank you very much for coming. Philippe, you've got immense experience both as a foreign correspondent and now as an advocate with one of the world's leading human rights advocacy organisations. Your article sets out the case that the Holocaust was not tragically the last atrocity. Yet you suggest that the global reaction to recent human rights atrocities has been pitiful. What's happened to the pledge of never again?
Well, thank you first for having us, and I'm really happy to be here and debate these difficult issues. What happened to it? I don't know. You know, it's uh, it's quite puzzling to me to look at where we are today. And you know, I think the world has clearly always been a very violent place. Mass atrocities or serious crimes have always been part of the picture, sadly. But when I started in that field, you know, something like 20 years ago as a young journalist covering the UN in New York, I would say it was a more hopeful time. The world had gone through Rwanda, which we just had the anniversary of the genocide there, Bosnia, and there was the idea at the time that the world was not going to tolerate mass atrocities ever again, or that at least it would try to fight them with purpose. So it was the time where the notion of the responsibility to protect was developed, quite a revolutionary idea at the time that actually sovereignty, state sovereignty, did not apply in situations of mass atrocities. And as you said, Gareth Evans and others were real pioneers in propagating this idea. It was endorsed by the UN General Assembly in 2005, which was also amazing at the time for activists around the world to see that states were coming together and actually accepting this idea. It's the time also, the late 90s, early 2000s, where the International Criminal Court based in The Hague was getting off the ground. Again, quite a revolutionary idea that you can be a sitting head of state or government, but that you're not above the law, and that if you commit serious crimes, some of the worst crimes, crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing, crimes of this nature, you can be held accountable. And dozens of countries were signing on to join the International Criminal Court. So I would say it was certainly an era of hope and of progress. Now, you know, it's never worked perfectly. You know, even 10, 15 years ago, there were some serious crises, but there were attempts at managing or mitigating some of the atrocities, whether it was in the Ivory Coast, for example, where there was a big crisis. The president at the time, Laurent Gbagbo, was committing crimes to stay in power. Eventually, after a Security Council resolution, and a sort of very proactive peacekeeping from French peacekeepers and UN peacekeepers on the ground, he was ousted, you know, led out of power, eventually in a cell in The Hague. The crimes in Libya sadly is again, you know, these days in the headlines. Gaddafi at the time was threatening to go after the rats, kill people in their, you know, in their homes. Again, there was a Security Council resolution. The situation was referred to the ICC. There was a NATO-led military intervention to stop these crimes. Now, I'm not endorsing any of these interventions, and you know, the history has shown us that actually they were quite problematic in different ways, but there was the political will, I would say, in the international community to do something. Now, fast forward, you know, 15, 20 years later, where are we today? We have, and Chris will speak to that much more eloquently than I could, but we have a potential genocide that is ongoing in Rakhine State in Myanmar, right? With over 700,000 people who have been chased out of Myanmar in a matter of weeks. You know, we had not seen something of that magnitude in a very long time. And what price has the Burmese government paid so far? Well, not very high. Certainly not high enough that they would switch their tactic in any significant way. So that's one here, quite close to home. Quite close to here as well, the situation in Xinjiang in China, which, you know, is also a situation of incredible magnitude. I mean, sometimes numbers, it's hard to convey how serious something is just with numbers. But the idea that a country can put into re-education camps 1 million people, 1 million, you know, citizens, is actually amazing. The infrastructure that you need to achieve that, how many camps you need to build, the system of control that you need to build, it's abuses of a scale that we had not seen in China since the Mao era. Again, what price has China paid for this policy? Close to nothing. The Security Council has, of course, never discussed it. China is a permanent member. The Human Rights Council has passed no resolution. There has been no commission of inquiry, pretty much nothing. Yes, a few governments have expressed concern, but nothing that would amount to meaningful international pressure, at least that would amount to pressure that would be commensurate with the gravity of the crimes. So that's China for you. Then you have, of course, you mentioned the war in Syria, which has now been going on for years. the Russian military has been instrumental in maintaining President Assad in power. Russia has used its veto power in the Security Council, I think by now I sort of lost track, but 8 or 9 times to block any meaningful international action. What price are they paying for that? Again, not much. In fact, they are doing just fine. You know, the war is sort of drawing to an end. The Syrian government has won, essentially, and Russia bet on the right horse and is going to reap the benefits of that. So Russia, China, both deeply involved in mass atrocities. And then you look at the situation in Yemen, which you mentioned. Again, proportions that are very hard to convey. An entire country, which was already the poorest country in the region to begin with, which is now on the brink of total collapse and chaos, cholera, massive epidemic of cholera. And I mean, you could talk about the situation probably much better than I could. According to the UN, the worst humanitarian emergency as we speak. And who is behind this one? Well, it's Saudi Arabia, who led the coalition that started the war in Yemen. And who is behind Saudi Arabia? It's another 3 permanent members of the Security Council, the US, France, and the UK, 3 countries that at least, you know, theoretically pretend to defend human rights on the global scene and stand for human rights, something that at least China and Russia do not even claim. But they sell billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars of weapons to Saudi Arabia, knowing full well that many of these weapons will be used to strike school buses and hospitals and you know, wedding ceremonies, civilian targets. So it exposes a complete double standard from countries that are supposed to actually uphold some of these norms that the world has worked on. So it's quite I realize it's quite a grim you know, outlook. It's not very uplifting on all of these issues. I think there are things that we can do as human rights organizations, that journalists can do, UN, you know, investigators like Chris are doing. We are making a difference on all of these issues, but I think it's a real time of danger. It's a time where it feels a bit like we are at a crossroads, and if some countries like Australia and other European countries, or the countries that believe in human rights, do not stand up and try to mitigate some of these atrocities, tomorrow's world will be dominated by these type of situations, and the likes of Russia and China will set the global tone. And it's something that personally worries me a lot, and something that we at Human Rights Watch are very eager to counter.
Sophie, I'm going to go to you, because of course you saw firsthand in the Middle East, in particular in Syria and Yemen, some of the things that Philippe talked about. Would you agree that we've reached some sort of a tipping point in terms of the scale and severity of the sort of human rights violations that you witnessed?
I mean, for me, it was a normalisation of it. That's what horrified and terrifies me. As someone who always wanted to be a Middle East correspondent and who cares passionately about these issues, and then you arrive there and you meticulously document some of these things that we're talking about right at the start. For example, when we went to Yemen, it was mid-2016, the war had been going on for a year, and children were already beginning to starve to death because of the Saudi-led blockade on that country in the capital, in Sana'a. And so we did a documentary, you know, children starving to death in front of us, literally. A child was in a bed one day, 6 hours later, he was gone. And so you report this, and it goes out there. And I guess when I wanted to be a journalist growing up, I witnessed things like East Timor, where I saw journalists sneak into a country and show the world what was going on. And you did see some movement. And then my generation is one where kids are starving to death. You know, here it is. It's available. You can go there and film it and show the world. Or it comes out from Aleppo, and it comes out from Madaya in Syria and Ghouta on WhatsApp. You know, at all hours of the day, I used to get these photos and images of bombings and hospitals and, you know, starving children. And it's all put out there. And that idea that nothing happens, that's the bit that concerns me, is that this overload of information, has it forced us to retreat? That somehow those stories don't have as much impact? Because I think back of, like, for example, in Sri Lanka in 2009, I know Philippe worked on examining the UN's response to that incredible failure to help those Tamil civilians. You know, 40,000 minimum is the conservative estimate of how many people were besieged and trapped in that horrific situation. And we didn't hear much about that. There were no journalists. There was no WhatsApp. You know, there was no one telling us the horror, the people who were tens of thousands starved to death. Very, very similar to what I was getting live from Syria. But the result was the same. Whether we didn't know or we knew, we had the same result. And what I find the most frustrating about the last few years covering it is, I think that the inaction of the UN is a large part of the problem. We saw this specifically in Syria. I think the using food as a weapon of war, we've had the two horrific examples of Syria and Yemen. And on the ground in Syria, from the very start of the conflict, the UN didn't stand up to Assad. He needed them more than they needed him, yet they allowed themselves to be pushed around by the regime to get visas approved. They came to the conclusion that it was more important to have access to the government and to be there and to have their staff had visas than to speak out and to really be loud and talk about what was happening. So, for example, in a town like Madaya, where children were starved to death in the end of 2015, early 2016, because it was 30,000 people surrounded by Hezbollah and Syrian government troops, you had the ICRC go on a convoy to that town in October, and parents begged those ICRC staff for baby milk. Not a word was said. You had another convoy that went to that town end of December. By that stage, several babies had starved to death. Not a word was said. It was only when a doctor in that town sent pictures of these starving children out to journalists, and they quickly went around the world. Samat the Power talked about them at the General Assembly, and the international community was outraged. They wanted to send food to Madaya. They got three shipments of food. 85 more people starved to death in that town after Samat the Power, you know, referred to these photos that had been smuggled out. And the UN then showed that same pattern of behaviour in several other besieged communities throughout Syria. Assad was able to use food and aid as a weapon of war. And really, I think that UN presence enabled him. And the lessons that the UN tried to learn after Sri Lanka, you look at Syria and none of it was applied. This whole idea of human rights up front, which was a massive change that was implemented in the UN after the failure to speak out and to call what was happening in Sri Lanka for what it was. And I've heard stories of UN staff in Damascus giving a copy of the report on Sri Lanka to colleagues and saying, you know, what have we learned? And the same patterns continue to the point where when I was interviewing a UN staff member who was trying to get food into Ghouta, and she accidentally said that, you know, the Assad government besieging it. And she said, oh, you can't put that in your story that I said it was the Syrian government besieging and starving, you know, these children. And to me, that's a huge part of the problem, is that there's no, that the UN had lost a lot of moral authority over Syria. And then also Western countries by the way that we support the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, who are we to talk about food as a weapon of war? I mean, I remember when the Russian foreign minister was coming out of a meeting at the UN and all the reporters were trying to ask him about that day's horror in Aleppo, the number of kids, you know, and he said, oh, I'm sorry, I have to go to another meeting about Yemen. And so where's the leadership? You know, this is the problem. So much moral authority has been lost within the UN system and within countries, as Philippe said, like the UK, the US, France and Australia, who say that we stand up for these principles. On the ground, you can't see that.
Chris, we have to obviously get to the Rohingya, but I want you to just quickly respond to this idea that you know, these sort of atrocities are sort of a new normal as opposed to, as you mentioned, possibly just more of the same.
It is more of the same. I agree with Philip's paper, but I wouldn't describe it as the new normal so much as the old normal and the continuing normal. It has always been thus. I mean, you can go back to the Jewish, Christian and Islamic scriptures and you'll see stories of atrocities going back to 2000 and more BC. So it's always been thus. But I risk sounding a naively optimistic but very small positive note. If we're looking for something that is new, what is new is first that these atrocities are no longer considered to be morally acceptable, and that was not always so. And second, that they are no longer considered to be legally tolerable, legally acceptable. Moral acceptability and legal acceptability has gone. So much so that the State Council in Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, has to deny that this actually occurred, and the government of China denies what is going on in Xinjiang province. It was not always so. One of the issues in the 1930s, when the Nazi regime in Germany started the persecution of the Jews, was that that was the concern of a sovereign state, and the international community had no interest in it, literally, until something international happened and the Nazi regime moved outside the borders of then Germany. That's no longer acceptable, legally or morally. But saying that, though, I mean, I do want to introduce that positive note, because there's a risk otherwise that the horror stories become overwhelming and we develop a sense of powerlessness, and that sentences the world to a continuation of the old normal, and that's simply not good enough. The problem now is very much an implementation problem, an implementation of a different moral judgment and a different legal framework to stop the atrocities from occurring. As Philippe's comments indicated, you know, I look back at the 1990s, in spite of Rwanda and former Yugoslavia, almost as the high watermark of human rights post-World War II. And that was because of the historic nature of the period. The Russian Empire had collapsed. China was battered by what had happened in Tiananmen, both domestically and internationally. The United States had a more human rights positive, or shall we say, a less human rights negative regime than it does currently. And the commitments of the right to protect and so forth that Philippe describes were very much the product of the political historical circumstances of the period between the collapse of the Russian Empire and, say, 2005-2006, when Russia started to re-emerge not as a great power, but as a spoiler power, a meddling state. And when the Chinese government moved away from the Deng Xiaoping approach of don't allow anybody to notice us to reasserting its great power role. I mean, China is a great power, Russia is not, in terms of geopolitics today. So we've seen change, dramatic change since 2005 that has seen us move backwards. But the implementation gap is still there. And I think the implementation gap has been made more difficult by the obvious failure of military interventions during the early 2000s, whether we talk about Afghanistan or Iraq, that has caused a grave concern at the use of military power as a means of protecting the right or defending the right to protection and exercising the right to protect. And I think that there is not only a loss of political will, but also a sense of powerlessness on the part of many states as to what they can actually do that's effective. And yet, what Sophie describes of the UN's failure is absolutely dead right. And Myanmar is a great example of that. There was a little noticed trial run in Rakhine State for what happened in August 2017. and that happened in October 2016. On that occasion, far less than 10 or 20,000 people were killed, and only 200,000 people were forced to cross the border, and nothing happened. You know, there was no response. All the warning signs were there, and there was absolutely no response. And unless we are prepared to say that continuing dialogue is the most important requirement, prerequisite, which is what happened in 2016, it was better to continue dialogue with the Myanmar government than it was to confront on the basis of what was going on. Unless we move away from diplomacy at all costs to a more early and effective response to gross human rights violations, atrocities, we're going to continue to have the old normal being repeated.
Philippe, do you agree with that? Is it the accountability that is now important? How do you think sort of states, NGOs, civilians, how should they be acting now to sort of drag themselves out of this passivity in relation to these crises?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with Chris, and especially with his vision of, you know, not taking from this grim observation that things are, you know, that impunity dominates today and feel powerless about it. I think it should be the opposite. I hope we can all collectively feel actually outraged and empowered to change that, because it's possible. I agree that accountability is absolutely key. I strongly believe that autocrats, criminals around the world take their cues from one another. And when a government sees that you can get away with, you know, a violation somewhere, it will give them confidence that they can get away with the same and maybe more. So I think it's very hard to prove these kind of relationships, but that's why I personally have always been a big believer in international justice and in the International Criminal Court. I think when someone like Laurent Gbagbo at the time was sent to The Hague, it sends a very strong signal. When someone like Hissène Habré of Chad gets thrown in jail, it sends a very strong signal. On the other hand, when someone like Assad can, you know, murder hundreds of thousands of people and still be president and still, you know, be part of the international community, that sends an even stronger message. So we try to bring back some measure of accountability on all of these issues. First, what we can do as human rights organization, it's not accountability per se, but we can shame publicly these governments for what they are doing and shame the countries that are making it possible for them to do that. So I think that's an important role. The truth-telling part, which journalists do as well, I think still raises the cost for abuse. You know, they can still commit them, but not, I would say, not in the dark. Whether it's on Syria or on Myanmar, we have been trying to look at creative way to bring back some measure of accountability. So, for example, when Chris's investigation is done in Myanmar, there will be a new body set up that will help preserve some of the evidence of the crimes that have been committed, prepare them for the possibility of one day bringing them to an actual tribunal. We don't know whether it would be, you know, maybe one day the ICC, maybe another mechanism, but at least someone is keeping, safeguarding the evidence. We advocated for a similar body to be created on Syria called the IIIM. It was created through a General Assembly resolution, and it's doing pretty much the same work, you know. So if you're a war criminal in Syria right now, you're scot-free for now, but you know that maybe someone is compiling evidence against you that may come back to bite you one day. So I think these are the kind of things that we can do. I think the International Criminal Court is still a very important institution. It's been going through quite a bit of trouble politically. Some of the investigations have not always been exemplary. Now it's under attack by the U.S. administration in an unprecedented way. The John Bolton, the national security advisor in the U.S., has pretty much announced to the world that he was going to campaign against the ICC and try to make it impossible for the ICC to do its work. So the ICC prosecutor doesn't have a visa to go to the U.S. anymore, which is absolutely crazy and mind-boggling. The U.S. has been threatening to actually sanction ICC officials, prosecutors, judges who may be going after either US officials for crimes committed in Afghanistan or possibly one day in Iraq, or US allies. So there is a sort of open war by the US on the accountability system, and we need to push back against that. But I think it's for as long as people get away with murder, we'll see murder all over the place.
Safi, speaking of getting away with murder, I know that your job as a journalist is to witness and record. But did you see anything? Do you see any hope in the way that some states are reacting to these sorts of crises? Do you distinguish between, you know, the way that the UN responds, for example, which you say is hopeless, compared with some other states in terms of intervening or providing assistance or speaking up?
Oh, look, I mean, I despair at the moment, you know, and I feel so many people in the fields of journalism or diplomacy or humanitarian fields just feels like there's this collective moral injury right now where you're screaming into an abyss and it's all there, and the lack of action is so demoralizing. And my struggle as a journalist is to think, how does telling stories help when the fear is that all of this information is causing retreat and causing people to be so terrified of what's going on out there that they just don't want to know? So, and I think the next step is trying to convince people in a country like Australia that, well, why a rules-based system matters and how it can come back and affect us even here. That there is a thing such as the truth and facts, and how you can see that can have an impact in a conflict like Syria, where people argue over whether that chemical attack was fake or not. And, you know, this disinformation that we have in our society now is so dangerous, and I've seen the harm it can do in a place like Syria and Yemen, but we also have it happen in our society with some of our political issues where we can't seem to decide basic truths anymore and basic facts, and somehow you're allowed to just claim different stories, you know, different interpretations of the truth, I think is how Trump's spokeswoman put it once. Their truth, I think she said. I think that is a way to move forward, is for us here to try and get our communities to realise that it might seem far away and it doesn't affect us, but this kind of global breakdown in the rules, that there are no rules, it will come back and hurt us, and it already is in some ways. And the other thing is, I think that as communities who care about these issues, a country like Australia has no excuse not to do more. You know, 27 years of economic growth, and yet our foreign aid has been slashed to a historically low level. I mean, to see these families stream out of Mosul, where they have been starved and shot at and under coalition bombing for weeks, and they get to these camps and there is nothing, you know, and they're sleeping on a piece of concrete if they're lucky. And there's no food and no water. And yet we had the money for the military campaign, you know, Australia, $1.8 billion for the military campaign, but only $150 million for the aid. I mean, what do we think is going to happen to these hundreds of thousands of disenfranchised Sunni families now in that part of the world? I mean, the next ISIS is just going to come along. So it's that failure to operate on a humanitarian level that, to me, it's intuitive. But where did we lose that? That's the bit that gets me. And so I hope that this country will use its position of privilege to be a leader. Because you see in the region like the Middle East, countries like Sweden and Norway consistently punching above their weight in areas of humanitarian law and aid and conflict. And I don't think we have an excuse not to be up there. You know, I think we're an amazing country. And I would be so proud to see us really step up and lead on some of these issues.
If I can, on that, the sort of short-sightedness of government is something that really strikes me. Governments like, you know, Australia, my country, a lot of European countries, for example, are very concerned with the flow of refugees, even though compared to countries that are actually neighboring some of these crisis zones, they have a very small share of the flow of refugees. They are extremely concerned about it. So, you know, and in fact, we have more refugees or people on the move right now than we've had since Second World War. And you know, that's one of the actual statistics that gives you a sense that, yes, we know that all of these things have always been happening, but we are living in a particularly dangerous time. Because what are these people fleeing? 60 million people, what are they fleeing? They are fleeing abuse, discrimination, human rights violations, persecutions. So if you really care about the flow of refugees and you want to go to the root of the problem, well, as a Western country that has actually quite a bit of power, you advocate in these countries. You don't want Rohingya boat people to arrive on your shore. Pressure, twist the arms of the Burmese military to stop persecuting them. Your European country, you don't want to see Syrians or Iraqis or people from Sudan come to your shore. Try to address the human rights conditions in these countries. It costs relatively very, very little money. They don't do that. Instead of doing that, they are trying to stop the flow. So not go at the root cause, but make it harder for people to exactly building walls. Or, you know, European countries are going to give money to the Sudanese government to better control its frontier, are going to give money to the Libyan Coast Guard to stop boats from crossing. So I think it's very short-sighted. And often I think some of these governments, France, the US, the UK, Australia, if you look at the situation in Yemen, they are compromising very, very serious principles. They are compromising their ability to advocate on human rights issues for what? For a few contracts with, you know, military firms that, I get it, there is an economic interest there, but the larger interest of these countries is to have a world order where people follow rules, where the world is at peace and where the world is prosperous. But often I think they, you know, they see the short-term benefit of the arms deal, but they don't understand the long-term implications of what they are doing.
Chris, there's a few things going on here. You know, questions of whether to intervene, whether to, you know, provide humanitarian aid, or the question of peace, and then leading to the issue of accountability. What's the most important? Is it the intervention to stop the conflict in the first place? Is it the humanitarian aid to assuage the concerns on the ground? Or is it ultimately peace and then accountability?
I'll opt out by saying all of them, because they're all interconnected.
I'm not going to let you do that.
Let me focus on the last, though, because I think the last is where there's a lot of disagreement, or at least I have a lot of disagreement. You know, often you get the argument presented that there is a choice between peace and reconciliation on the one hand and accountability on the other. Now, I mean, I'm not an expert in every country in the world. Maybe that is the case in some countries. I mean, certainly I would say that leaving accountability aside to stop the killing, if that's what it takes, I can countenance that, even as a human rights lawyer. I liked what happened in South America at the end of the national security regimes in the 1980s, where to get rid of the military, they gave them all an amnesty, and then 15 years later, they revoked the amnesties and put them all in jail. I can live with that. But in the case of a country like Myanmar, there is no choice. We do not have peace because there has been no accountability. And we will not have peace in Myanmar until there is accountability. It's precisely because the military has got away with what they do for the last 60 years that they continue to do it. And for me, in the case of Myanmar, accountability is about prevention in the future. It's not just about justice for the past. So it's an unreal choice to pose it as a choice. It's an unreal proposition to say, do you support accountability or should we go for peace? Because you're not going to have peace in a country like Myanmar until and unless you've got accountability. But can I go back, not to your point though, Alex, but to Sophie's, to reinforce it. Truth and fact. I mean, this is really important. I was at an academic conference on Myanmar a couple of weeks ago, and you know, the academics were talking about the two narratives on what happened in Rakhine State. The narrative of the Myanmar government and the narrative, it was described as a narrative of the international media and the international community. And I understand, I'm not stupid, I understand the technical meaning of the academic term narrative, but the use of it implies an equivalence. And there is no equivalence. One is true and one is false. One is factional and the other is fictional. And we have to stop pretending that every version of truth is equally acceptable. When we started with the Myanmar fact-finding mission, I mean, we were confronted with an overwhelming situation. And one of our first questions was, what can we hope to accomplish? You know, particularly given the politics of the Security Council. And, you know, in that first discussion, we said, at the very least, if nothing else, we have an obligation to establish the historic record of what happened. We do not want a situation in a century's time like the Armenian genocide where we still debate what happened. The people, the Rohingya people, are entitled to the truth. So I don't, for a minute, suggest or want to suggest that there are versions of truth, that there are different facts, there are different narratives, there may be different interpretations or different propaganda pieces, but there is truth and fact, and there is falsehood and fiction. And we have to maintain that distinction.
Well, I think we've hit on the debate of the 21st century there. We can continue it now. We've got about 20 minutes for questions and answers.
Thanks. Thank you very much for this fascinating debate. My name is Vic Aladef. I'm CEO of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies. I'd like to put a question to Chris. Both you and Sophie touched on the issue of the United Nations. The UN is a sick joke, as we know. And you have situations where a country like Iran, where girls from the age of 9 can be forcibly married, yet take a leader position on the Commission for the Status of Women. Equally, Saudi Arabia, women cannot have a bank account, the evidence in court is half of the males, and yet they are on the Commission for the Status of Women. Does it matter that the Human Rights Commission in particular, the UN itself, is completely impotent on human rights issues? And if it does matter, given that only about 45% of the UN countries are actually democracies, 88 out of 193 is the number I saw recently, given that only minority are democracies, is there ever any a possibility that the situation can be reformed, that the UN can actually acquire teeth and be actually effective in the realm of human rights?
Tough question.
Are we doing one at a time? So I'm happy to start. Or
yes, I think we'll take this one, and then perhaps both of you can comment.
You know, I agree, Vic. It's the UN. Yeah, you know, let's be frank. The UN is inherently compromised by its structure, and ever will be so. Anything that is made up of nation states is inevitably compromised by the politics of the nation states, and whether it's Trump's America or Australia under whatever government emerges. Nation states will always give priority to their own perceived national interests, even if it's short-term national interests rather than long-term. So, you know, if we are going to have an international organisation built on the bedrock of nation states, we're always going to have to deal with these issues. You know, sometimes in one of my, you know, in my more depressed days, I think it's a bloody miracle that the UN has accomplished as much as it has. Certainly, it's a surprise. Do we scrap it and start again? Yeah, there's a lot of arguments for that. I'm not quite sure, though, whether we'd wind up with anything better than what we've got. But, you know, I've invested a lot of time and energy over the years in trying to get as much as is possible out of an inherently defective system. And we have seen possibilities come out of it, whether it's in the law, where I think the body of international law now in human rights is excellent. In some of the more legally based structures, like the International Criminal Court, with all of the shortcomings Philippe mentions, the treaty bodies that supervise the human rights treaties are generally made up of independent legal experts. Not all are independent, not all are expert, but generally. You know, there are aspects of the system that are performing well, but the biggest challenge of all is to try to move beyond the individual politics and short-term visions of nation states to say that the ultimate interest of all of our nations is a world that is prosperous, peaceful, democratic, and human rights respecting, and to convince states that that's where our long-term interest lies. But we're not going to change them from thinking first about themselves. We have to change their perception of what is in their national interest.
Yeah, maybe I feel compelled to answer because I was a correspondent at the UN for 10 years almost as a journalist. So I know the many ways the organization is perverted and infuriating in many cases. I would say there is another side to the UN and that for us it's still an important tool. The reason why Chris was empowered to investigate the situation in Myanmar and produce actually amazing reports that tell the truth is because we have a Human Rights Council that created this commission of inquiry, as they did with many other places. Yes, China is under Human Rights Council, Saudi Arabia is under Human Rights Council, Burundi. You know, some of the world's worst violators are sitting on it, but still, when member states of goodwill, you know, decide to stick their neck out and try things out, you can have progress, small progress, but you can have progress. We have a commission of inquiry on Yemen that has done amazing work and that was created only because the Netherlands decided to push for that in the Human Rights Council, which was an incredibly courageous decision. They got a lot of flak for doing that. Saudi Arabia went crazy, canceled some contracts, really went all out to punish them. It took them almost 3 years. We human rights organizations were trying to help, but it succeeded, and there is now, you know, a commission of inquiry that every time there is a strike, as happened only a couple of days ago, somebody is taking note and reporting back to the international community. So I think it's still a very important tool. I think we have to be outraged the way you are when we see countries like Iran or Saudi Arabia try to game the system, which they do all the time. And in fact, China is expert at that. But it's also the best tool we have. And if countries of goodwill, and I would say Australia could potentially be one of these countries that has enough power and influence to be a player, a significant player at the Human Rights Council. They have a seat at the council. They could use it much more proactively. In fact, I was in Canberra yesterday trying to make that case. If countries like Canada, some of the Nordic countries you mentioned, Australia, band together to try to hold China accountable or hold Saudi Arabia accountable, we'll have a better UN system tomorrow.
Hi, thank you. Very fascinating panel. My name's Rowan. I'm from the newly established legal centre called the Australian Centre for International Justice, and we're hoping to develop Australia's universal jurisdiction mechanism. So my question is on the power of universal jurisdiction cases around the world, particularly in Europe and Canada and the US, of course, and what Australia can do in its obligation to undertake this kind of work and action.
I think there's definitely one for you, Chris.
Except I know Rowan, and we've been talking together
about this. It's a Dorothy Dixer.
It was
Dixer,
a printed question.
It must be Dorothy Dixer. No, it's... That's the other side that Philippe did not mention. There's not only the International Criminal Court, where we can hope to see some response, or international tribunals like the specialist tribunals on Rwanda and former Yugoslavia. There is also the possibility of national courts exercising international jurisdiction. But these most serious international crimes can be tried in any court in the world, including Australian courts. And so far as Syria is concerned, there is an example underway already in Germany. I mean, the Security Council will not give the International Criminal Court a reference on Syria, and there's no tribunal. But the German courts are already starting prosecutions with one or two people that they happen to be able to get their hands on within their jurisdiction, based on the work that international bodies like our Myanmar body and these mechanisms that are being established are founding. So there's a lot of possibility that has not been fully explored for international jurisdiction being exercised by national courts. It does require that one of the alleged perpetrators set foot within the jurisdiction and be latched onto. But if it's one thing that people in power who perpetrate human rights violations like to do, it's travel, mainly because their countries are often pretty miserable places. And so monitoring, watching, and catching when they travel. These are very important steps which international jurisdiction gives rise to possibilities that are not even starting to be properly exploited now.
There's a question down here, and I might take three questions.
Thank you. It's Brian Everingham, Institute of International Affairs, but for 37 years also teaching history. And I cannot but help comment that many of the largest, most atrocious crimes against human rights happen to be as a result of conflict in some way, shape or form. And some of the worst have been as a result of interventions in countries where there's been no exit strategy or no peace process. I think probably the one of the worst and most egregious is Donald Rumsfeld's We Do Not Do State Building. And I look at Afghanistan, I look at Libya, I look at Syria, and I think, have you really made matters better by going in without knowing that there is a peace that follows war? I'd like a comment.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk. It's really interesting. I'm Rachel. I'm doing my Master's of International Security at the University of Sydney. I'm just really curious to understand and get your perspective on whether you think there might be inherent limitations within human rights discourse that really fail to capture international complicity in producing human rights violations in the first place, and whether they perhaps that perhaps even contributes to the normalisation of violence that we touched on before.
Hi, I'm Sacha Danlowe from the University of Sydney, PhD candidate. In most of the cases that were raised by the panel, there is a major power, for generally a Security Council member, but also powers like India, that is a permissive patron in the background that is able to provide a level of protection. But also, most of those same patrons have restrained other states from conducting genocide and mass atrocities because it's in their interests. We've discussed a lot about the moral imperative to prevent atrocities, but I'm wondering if you think there is any way of shifting the geopolitical and national interests of these states from a permissive function in most cases to a restraining one, as happens in many other cases.
Right, whoa, tough one from university students. Firstly, Brian's question about the conflicts becoming, as a result of interventions without an exit strategy. Philippe, do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. Militarily intervening in any country is a messy proposition. Doing it in the names of democracy or human rights is even messier. I started my career in Kosovo in 1999 after the NATO intervention there. Kosovo is literally a dot on the map. It's a minuscule territory. There were 40,000 NATO troops there, and they were not able to maintain peace even years after the intervention. Now, look at countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is, you know, the size of Western Europe and where you have maybe between 15 and 20,000 UN peacekeepers. So I don't really have much faith in military intervention as a tool of imposing human rights norms or advancing democracy. And you're right, we've seen how it plays out in Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. My problem with that, though, is that it's often used by countries to justify complete inaction. So for me, between, you know, tolerating genocide and launching a military intervention to stop it, there is a whole range of tools that can be used to actually mitigate violations or put an end to them. And I think often these tools are quite simple. It's imposing an arms embargo, sanctioning, you know, individual perpetrators, Burmese military officials who want to travel, well, impose a travel ban, asset freezes on them, target military-owned companies in these countries, refer a situation to the International Criminal Court, create a commission of inquiry, make statements. So there is a lot that can be done to stop atrocities short of military intervention. I do believe that in some cases, military intervention might be an unavoidable tool, but I would say in recent histories, it's been used too quickly or under false pretenses, which has sort of given a bad name to the responsibility to protect in many circles. But again, in every single situation that I mentioned, we are not advocating for any type of military intervention, and we think that there are tools out there that will do no damage and will be quite effective at exercising pressure on some of these governments.
Sophie, I'm going to put this one to you and the question about whether the international community has become complicit in these human rights violations through the normalisation of violence. I think you probably feel the same way.
Oh, 100%. I think what Lee pointed out when he was talking about the inability to act when it's the hypocrisy that gets me, you know, when you see food used as a weapon of war in Syria and you're outraged and we'll condemn it, but then nothing is said about Saudi Arabia. So I think that any casual observer would I think just you can just see how the system doesn't work in reality. I just get so frustrated when at the double standards and when you're on the ground and you're trying to draw attention to a situation and it is exactly the same, but you know your leader won't call it out for what it is there, but they will in another situation. So I think that's where the complicity comes from. The one point I also wanted to make in terms of the battle for the truth and the facts, as Chris mentioned, that they do exist, is there's been a really disturbing trend I've seen in the last few years about picking and choosing what to believe from who. So I look at an organisation like Human Rights Watch that Philippe works for, and their solid reporting on the ground, you know, the work that they have done in a country like Syria and Yemen has been so valuable. And yet you've had a whole political order pick and choose when to believe Human Rights Watch. You know, we can trust them when they're talking about Syria, but Gaza, you know, or the West Bank, we won't believe that. And it's maddening as a reporter when people will hold up my Syria reporting and say, oh yeah, you know, amazing work and the horrific stories, but then they can't trust me on Gaza or, you know, the West Bank or Yemen, you know. So when you're working in those fields as a journalist, you are collating the brilliant work of brave people in an organisation like Philippe's, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, people on the ground in different UN agencies, and that's where who you're relying on to get that truth that Chris and Philippe and I desperately believe in. And so it's the picking and the choosing, you know, that gets me when I'll rely on these groups in all different scenarios, where the war crimes are being committed in Yemen, in Syria, in Libya, in Gaza. There is a truth and there are people you can trust in all those situations. But the left and the right side of politics increasingly can only see one side if it aligns, you know, with American interests or kind of what they see, you know, see as kind of an imperialist motive. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a bit rambling, but
that's okay.
It
was a tough question. Now we've got 1 minute left. So Chris, I'm going to do something really unfair to you, and I'm going to get you onto the third question about is there any way of changing sort of major power geopolitics in providing protection and I think facilitation, I think was your question, which is allowing these atrocities to occur with impunity?
I have to believe, yes.
Leave us with a shred of hope.
No, and Philippe and Sophie also. I mean, we three would not be doing what we're doing if we did not hold out the hope that a better way of approaching human rights protection is possible. Perhaps in one sense I've foreshadowed that already by talking about long-term national interest rather than short-term national interests. That the power of persuasion, of advocacy, which is Philippe's responsibility, of finding and exposing the facts, and of building a political constituency within countries for truth. And working in our favour is the fact that great power alliances shift constantly. You know, I'm not prepared to accept that China will always veto in the Security Council action against Myanmar. And I do that for good historical reasons, that these two countries keep on falling in and out of love. And they're going to fall out of love inevitably sometime in the next 5 years again, because that's what they do. The ways in which states operate change, and opportunities arise unexpectedly often, very often unexpectedly again. I think that's a historical fact. And being in a position to maximise the opportunities when they arise, to the extent that we can, play the games of international politics, but constantly, consistently arguing on the basis of law, a rules-based system that is now being attacked, as being in our common global interest. You know, that has to be the bottom line.
Thank you for leaving us with the bottom line. Our time is up. Thank you very much to all of you. I think this has been a fascinating conversation, I think useful as well. We've talked about infuriating the UN, military sales, aid budgets, fake news, the ICC, John Bolton, Sam Power, peace, truth, and falling in and out of love. So I think we've covered an enormous ground in an hour, and don't forget the facts. Thank you very much to our panel, Philippe, Sophie and Chris.